Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. And just a quick reminder, this is our last show of this year. We'll be back again the first week in January. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Greg Erickson of the Alaska Budget Report, and from Washington, Libby Casey of APRN. Libby, the congressional countdown to Christmas continues. The United States Congress is trying to work out a payroll tax cut. Also on the table, an omnibus spending bill, which seems to include virtually everything in it that the federal government does. Give us the updates on these two major issues.
Well, it sure seems like Congress needs a deadline to get anything done. And some of the articles in Hill publications today talked about the exhaustion, the desire to go home is a motivating factor to get some things passed. Whatever is motivating Congress, they're moving now in a way that they've been gridlocked for the last couple of weeks. You mentioned the two big things that are on the table, Michael. One is this big spending plan. So Congress has to come up with a spending plan, any spending plan, be it short-term or long-term, or else the government shuts down this weekend. That's because it's only funded through Friday night. But there was agreement late this week among Democrats and Republicans in the leadership on a spending plan, and it's to the tune of $1 trillion. We call it an omnibus because it's a whole bunch of spending bills lumped together and covers, you know, so many things, ranging from interior and environmental issues to homeland security to health and human services. It passed the House Friday afternoon, and the Senate is likely to vote on it this weekend and pass it. And it actually got a lot of support in the House, despite wrangling and teeth gnashing earlier, because Democrats were in the position of not even knowing entirely what was in it, not liking some things about it, but having to move forward or risk this government shutdown. The other thing that's on the agenda, and these two things have been tied together, is this extension of the payroll tax holiday. Americans got a reduction in taxes they saw coming out of their paycheck this past year, and it's very popular. Many folks want to see it continued over into next year. It's about $1,000. And Senator Begich's office says it affects 400,000 Alaskans. Now, Democrats wanted to pay for it with a tax increase on millionaires. They had to give up that because Republicans wouldn't budge. The House has passed a version that Republicans like. The problem is it's got some poison pills attached that Democrats don't like. For example, fast tracking of a pipeline. And no, before you get excited, it's not an Alaska gas line. It's that Keystone oil pipeline, the extension of the pipeline that would go through the lower 48. That's very controversial. And so the president said he's not going to sign that. So we'll see how they hammer that out over in the next couple of days. I did want to mention, so it looks like Congress will be in this weekend. We'll be in a little bit next week. The House will come back. They've got to get this stuff done before they can really go home for the holiday. I did want to mention a couple things in the omnibus that affect Alaska. One is a huge budget whack. The Office of the Federal Pipeline Coordinator, that's what Larry Persily runs. It has staff in Anchorage and Washington that's helping to try to get a gas line going. It takes a 75% hit to its budget. Now, they have a little bit of money saved up that they can rely on to fill the gap, but that's going to be a big change, and we'll see how that actually plays out. That's likely to come into being now to pass.
Maybe if I could interrupt you here. I know I can't see you, so we can't exchange hand signals here. Where's this desire for this kind of cut to the gas line office coming from? I mean, is this the administration? Is this certain members of Congress? Who's behind it?
Well, the White House has essentially signed off on it by not making a fuss over it. I interviewed Senator Barbara Boxer, influential Democrat from California, of course, who just isn't interested in incentivizing any oil and gas development. She says the industry can do it on their own. They don't need federal dollars. Thank you very much.
This is the way of telling
them. But what about the Alaska job? You know, the jobs, the getting, you know, Alaska gas to market, domestic supplies, and she was kind of shrugged her shoulders and walked away. So she's got a big role in this because she's the head of the Environment Committee.
Well, I imagine here what we've got in part is telling the Republicans, you want to save government money? Okay, here's your opportunity. Paul, the rhetorical fireworks in Washington have been quite explosive, and we have our own fireworks right here in Anchorage, but surprise, they're not rhetorical, they're real. What's going to happen New Year's Eve, especially at the Jenkins household?
Why, nothing, of course. The assembly, because it doesn't really want to deal with things like budget crunches that are on the horizon, that sort of thing, decided in its wisdom would restrict fireworks this year to you couldn't set them off within 200 feet of your neighbor's house. And they're also, of course, outlawed in mobile homes near hotels, motels, gas stations, the convenience stores, I guess.
Churches.
Yeah, churches, to pick a place. Last year, they said, okay, everybody have fun. Backing up, people on New Year's and July 4th here have always set off fireworks, law or no law. So last year, they said, well, let's codify the obvious and say, okay, for 4 hours, 5 hours, you can set off fireworks. Half the city went berserk. The other half had fun. So this year, to put an end to that, you can't have that many people having fun. Now, the assembly came up with a discriminatory in that if you don't have a lot that's 2.5 acres, you can't set off fireworks.
Now, Paul, what are the chances I'm going to go out somewhere before midnight on New Year's Eve and see somebody with a long tape measure trying to figure out where 200 feet from my house is?
I think the law will be broken with great vigor and in and all night long, I'm guessing. It's unenforceable, and it's capricious, and
we're having some wit here, and I'm a person who has dogs at home, and had dogs that it makes them delirious with fear and anxiety and so forth. So, and there are people individually who are affected by this, but it seems like it's a pretty hard behavior to regulate. That's what we're talking about.
It's unenforceable.
To regulate closely.
Absolutely unenforceable.
Okay. Greg, Governor Sean Parnell must by law have a budget out this December. We've seen it, but we need to get a better understanding of the detail of this very thick document. And we do know, of course, that there will be changes. So maybe you can take us through the general overview, and if you have some candidates for areas where we might see changes, what do you think?
Sure. Yes, Governor Parnell, as the Constitution requires, submitted his budget this week. And he emphasized that it's a proposal. Kind of missed in the news about that was that the Parnell administration also submitted a revised revenue forecast, which shows a lot more revenue than was expected back in April, about $3 billion more over the biennium. And that's an increase of almost 20%. And in this state, it's the revenue that drives the spending. And maybe that's true of most places. In any event, there's a lot of additional money that the legislature in January is going to have to decide what to do with. Parnell proposed a budget that is $600 million has $600 million less spending than the current year's fiscal year budget, the year we're in right now. But he made it clear that he'd be plenty happy if the legislature just added that $600 million back to wherever they felt it was appropriate, probably capital projects. That would leave $3 billion of surplus in FY12 and FY13, the current and next fiscal year. And Parnell proposes that go to the statutory budget reserve, which already has several billion dollars in it. I think the legislature will have some other ideas probably. Some of it probably will go to the statutory budget reserve, but I'm sure they would like to spend more on capital projects than he would like. It's a substantial, even if you add the $600 million back, it's a substantial reduction from what they spent this year, which was, in fact, a huge spending year for capital and other things.
If I might, Greg, what is Parnell's history as governor the last couple of years on proposing a budget and having the legislature come close to agreeing that that's the figure that they want to spend?
Well, last year, I mean, the real elastic item in the budget is the capital budget in the state, as that's seen as more amenable to building it up when revenues are flush and collapsing it down when they're scarce. Last year, the governor proposed a very small capital budget to begin with. In February, he added another several hundred million dollars additionally, quietly, without ever any publicity. And in the end, he permitted quite a large capital budget, although his vetoes were larger than any governor had vetoed out of the capital budget ever. Nevertheless, because the budget was so big, it was still the largest capital budget this state has had, at least on general funds. So he's been, I guess it would be fair to say, all over the map last year. I think he's being a little bit more straightforward this year. He's saying right off at the get-go that he is fine with this additional $600 million being added.
And because of reapportionment, 59 of the 60 legislative seats are going to be contested in this election, which is not the regular procedure. What impact is that perhaps to have on the process and the dollar outcome?
I don't think it augurs well for less spending. I think that spending is probably a helpful thing when you're running for office, and so we'll have to see. I mean, in this state, savings also is something you can run on, but it's not quite as concrete as the new school
or
the bridge.
Well, I mean, we have people run on savings and then spend it.
Yeah, right.
Okay, Libby, let's go back to Washington. The fallout from the Ted Stevens investigation continues. Briefly, what's the latest detail in the Ted Stevens matter?
Well, a group of senators of both parties is calling on the Justice Department to apologize for how botched that case went. They want an apology to go to the family of the late Senator Ted Stevens. And they also want the attorneys responsible fired. And it's interesting because it's some of Ted Stevens' old friends, like Orrin Hatch of Utah, who was stood by his side all throughout the trial in a way that a lot of other senators did not do. And then folks like California Dianne Feinstein. These are people who sit on judiciary who they almost had a moment a couple of weeks ago when they were talking about it with Attorney General Eric Holder of, like, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. I mean, if this happened to Ted Stevens, this could happen to any of us. And so the motivation seems in large part directed to Ted Stevens, but also as a message to the Justice Department of, got to get your ducks in a row, and this kind of thing can't happen. Senator Murkowski has been a very vocal advocate of trying to dig up what really happened here, and she's been incredibly critical, but her voice is being joined now with this broader chorus. I will point out that Senator Begich's mom on this, you know, it's a kind of a complicated thing. He won that election right after Ted Stevens was convicted in a conviction that was later thrown out, so he didn't talk about it. But Murkowski is getting some other folks now to pick up this drumbeat of figuring out what happened.
Libby, if I might, those who say the attorneys who in the Justice Department who are responsible for this misconduct should be fired, well, that's a nice sentiment, but we don't know, and I don't know that anybody's ever going to know publicly who was held accountable, if anybody. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's the thing. There are two investigations that have been going on. They're supposed to basically be, well, I was going to say be released early next year, but release is a funny word. They're supposed to be released within certain circles, so we don't know how public they're actually going to be, and we don't know how much information we're going to find out about the results. And a lot of people have called on Attorney General Eric Holder and others to make it public, but this may stay internal, and they may use the excuse of, it's a personnel matter, so we may not know. But the question is, too, is it a couple of rogue attorneys, or is this a culture at large, the Justice Department? And where does the buck really stop? How high up does it go?
Okay, thank you very much. Greg, when the legislative session opens, we are undoubtedly going to hear a lot about oil taxes. A good chance it'll be the number one issue, or at least tied in first place with capital spending. What are the prospects? We haven't had you on the show here for a few weeks. What have you learned recently, and what are the prospects for a change in oil tax as we prepare for the session next year?
You know, I'll go out on a limb, I guess, and say it depends. No, I think it certainly will be an issue next session. It was an issue this session, and it will be next session.
And already passed the House.
It already passed an oil tax bill passed the House. I think, though, that the legislators are, if not coming to a consensus on this, at least that there's a general suggestion among legislators that perhaps the oil taxes do take too much from the producers when prices are very high, and this is the other side of that coin, perhaps take too little from the producers or give them too many subsidies when at the outset, or take too little from the producers when prices are low. Back in 2007, when the ACES tax law was adopted, it was there was a conscious understanding that if we're going to raise the oil tax levels to the, you know, marginal rates that may be well above 50%, maybe above 70%, at very high prices, we have to offer something on the other end. So they cut the taxes very substantially at the lower end when oil prices are low.
We need a little context here. What is higher or above something and what is lower here?
The cutoff point officially is about $60 a barrel at the wellhead, where you start getting into the surtax, and at $140 a barrel, my recollection is that the state gets about, in total, about 70% or more of the marginal value of that additional revenue. So, to sort of make a complicated thing maybe a little oversimplified, the oil industry is sort of at risk here now, I think, because if they were to go along with a proposal that takes a little more from them when they're not doing, takes a little less from them when they're not doing well, and takes a little, takes a little more when their oil prices are low, and takes a little more when they're high, they could get whacked the way they got whacked in 2007, which was, you know, they passed that bill, and then oil prices shot up, and Alaska became fabulously rich. Well, if oil prices drop dramatically, Alaska could win on both sides. So I'm not sure the oil industry is going to be particularly excited about that kind of a deal. But I think that if there is a deal, it's probably going to be something along those lines.
Okay, and we'll have you back here to tell us about this as the session unfolds. Paul, you want to add anything here?
No, the only thing that I keep hearing any kind of talk about it is doing away somehow or modifying the ratcheting of the staircase tax increases, where you hit a level and then every time it goes up a buck or two, you ratchet it up 0.4%. And at the top rates, when you consider a marginal tax rate, that is that's ACES and corporate income tax and all the other taxes, you're talking more than 90%. So it makes these guys look at this like this is not some place we need to be. We need to be in North Dakota with a production tax of 11%.
Okay, I don't think that's coming too soon.
Well, I mean, I know, but the bottom line is we have to keep in mind, we're in competition. There are a lot of people out there with oil and gas.
Okay, Paul, let's stick with you. We don't spend a lot of time commenting or exploring criminal trials unless they involve major businesses or political figures. But the latest installment of the Linehan trial is really unusual. If you could tell us what's happened there and give us some perspective as somebody who was a younger man, covered courts quite extensively. It's a pretty unusual case.
A younger man?
I was trying to find a diplomatic way out of
this.
Or to let the viewers know it wasn't recently.
The Linehan case has been unusual since day one. It's got everything. It's got a stripper, it's got murder, it's got all the stuff you want to go watch court cases for. Michelle Linehan.
Letters from the grave.
Letters from the grave, which now the case is hinged on that. It's pivoting on that. Linehan was accused of manipulating a boyfriend to kill another former boyfriend. That former boyfriend wrote a letter to his parents and said, if anything happens to me, she did it. Well, somehow, he winds up dead. So here's the letter. The letter winds up in front of the grand jury, and the grand jury indicts. This is basically hearsay. How do you cross-examine a letter from a guy? And that's basically the only evidence I know of in the case, the fact that he thinks that she would be the one to do it. She was tried. She was convicted by a jury who knew this. I think to a lot of people's surprise that she was convicted. Appeals court tossed it out, said, nope, letter from the grave, probably influenced the jury. And now we have the judge, the Superior Court judge, looking at the indictment and saying, well, if it affected the jury outcome, it's got to also affect the indictment. So he tosses the indictment. She basically now is free. The state has 30 days from the time that he did this to come back and re-indict.
We don't know what the prosecutors will do, but we do know there are cases where whatever the prosecutor's feelings about and beliefs about the case, they come to the conclusion it's a case they can't make.
Well, it's not what you know, it's what you can prove.
Okay. Libby, let's get back to you. Congress has taken an interest in frankenfish, that remarkable, wonderful word to describe genetically modified salmon. Tell us what you've heard in Washington recently.
Right, well, Senators Murkowski and Begich have introduced a bill that would ban interstate commerce of these genetically engineered salmon. And Begich called for a hearing this past week in the midst of all the other busyness going on with Congress. He got a couple of experts down and the CEO of Aqua Bounty Technologies, the head of this company in Massachusetts that wants to market these salmon. And they sort of talked out what the issues here are. And the big concern is, how do you assure that these genetically modified salmon don't get out into the wild and breed? Because even though they've been created not to breed, there's the fear that they could anyway, that nature will find a way to win out. And so we heard some really interesting testimony from everyone from environmentalists to experts in fish genetics talking about this interesting moment of evolution of creating these genetically modified salmon. The FDA has jurisdiction over them, and you think it might be National Marine Fisheries Service or Interior. No, it's just the FDA to decide if they should go on your table. But folks are saying there should probably be a broader look at this, because it doesn't just affect your dinner plate. It also could affect the stocks of salmon in other places, including Alaska.
Is there, aside from, I guess I have to ask it this way, is there much of a lobbying group in favor of these genetically modified fish, or is it a small group against, what, Alaska and West Coast fishermen?
Yeah, it is a smaller contingent, it seems, and it's interesting when you get into the farm fish advocates. So the only other senator who was really interested in this issue yesterday at the Commerce Committee hearing was Olympia Snow of Maine, and she likes, you know, aquaculture, farmed fish that happens along her state border, but she's nervous about these frankenfish, these genetically modified salmon as well. So they are kind of fighting an uphill battle, but it was moving along through the FDA approval process until folks like Begich and Murkowski said, whoa, slow down. We need to figure out a way that we can get the public more involved in this process.
Okay, thank you very much. Greg Erickson, this is a prize. The ABC board, the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, has become a center of controversy. And the question is, for starters, of where the agency should be located within what the boundaries of what departments of the government. Tell us, what's at stake here, and where's the ABC board headed?
Well, right now it's in the Department of Public Safety, a public safety police agency. And Representative Mike Hawker, who's co-chair of the House Finance Committee and also on the powerful Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, wants to move it to a more business-friendly environment at Commerce and Economic and Community Development. And the reason he wants to do that is because the bar owners around the state feel that they are being picked on by the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board that sends these young folks in to try to buy alcohol who are underage, and sting operations. And I saw a letter from a owner of a bar in Kodiak who said, it's terrible. They'll give you a ticket if you don't have your TAM card, which is a card you have to sell alcohol. Certifies that you've been trained, right. I think the bottom line here is Governor Parnell says he's neutral. Department of Public Safety opposes the shift. So do the chiefs of police in Alaska. So do a lot of health agencies. But bottom line here is that the alcohol industry has good lobbyists. And those, ever since Mothers Against Drunk Driving sort of went, they haven't been active lately. We don't have that same kind of push to ensure the kind of effective enforcement that the current administration at the ABC has been bringing. So I'd say it's 50-50. Could pass, might not, but we'll
Paul,
just...
thank you, Greg. Paul, just get you in here briefly. I was smiling at you because I guess I'm just wondering what the sales pitch is in Alaska that the alcohol industry is suffering over-regulation from big government.
That's why I started laughing, too. I don't know. If you're not breaking the law in a bar, you really shouldn't care what these guys are doing. They come in, they run stings, they're trying to protect children. I don't, it's like he says, they have great lobbyists.
Okay, they have an issue they can present to the public, that they're a business and they participate in the community and they're being abused. That's the argument here, right?
Well, I don't think they're making an argument that they really want to make publicly. They really want to do this behind the scenes in the Capitol. And if it happens, that's probably how it's going to
happen.
For the
reason Jenkins and I were going back and forth about it. Yeah. Finally, Greg, let's let you have the last word here. We have a couple of minutes. The gas line. We haven't had you on the show here to discuss the gas line. What are you hearing, or gas lines, as we approach the session?
Something's got to happen on the gas line politically. Alaskans feel that the gas line is the It's a cornucopia that's going to bring in Fairbanks. I think it's going to bring them cheap energy. It's probably not, but that's the belief. It's been hanging around for well over 30 years. But what is going to happen remains very much up in the air. A general consensus that the large gas line through Canada is probably not going to happen anytime soon. And the question is, what else is out there? They proposed a $7 billion pipeline, to so-called bullet line, to come through Fairbanks and serve Anchorage with gas from the north. That pipeline would have to be almost entirely financed by the state, I think, and would very likely not be able to pay for itself, although there's some circumstances where it could. So there was interesting hints dropped just this week by Governor Parnell that there's somehow a new consensus developing around a Tidewater project. But what that turns out to be, we'll just have to wait and see.
Thank you, Greg. Interesting hint. We're out of time here. Thank you for joining us on Alaska Edition, and we'll be back next year. See you next year. Thank you.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.